Good morning. On today's programme, the persecution of a Bangladeshi Nobel laureate and the deadly battles on the Kenyan-Somali border. But first we go to Libya, where more than 11,000 people died when floods devastated the eastern part of the country a month ago. The worst hit area was the city of Derna. As Mary Fitzgerald reports, the floods and the resulting loss of life were in part caused by a natural disaster and part by human negligence.
In Derna, they are still counting the dead. It's now more than a month since Storm Daniel raged across the Mediterranean and slammed into this coastal Libyan town, bringing with it torrential rains and causing two nearby dams to burst. More than a month since Derna woke up to find that entire neighborhoods had been swept away by the deluge. More than a month since the terrible scale of the disaster slowly became apparent. The confirmed death toll climbed first into the hundreds and then into thousands. The UN described it as a calamity of epic proportions. 5 weeks later, thousands are still missing, most likely never to be found. Some residents told me of neighbors who go to the seafront every day in the hope that the bodies of their loved ones will yet wash ashore. Derna nestles in a storied part of the Mediterranean. It has a dramatic history, but nothing in living memory compares with the devastation wrought last month. I first visited Derna in 2011, during the uprising that toppled Muammar Gaddafi. It's an intimate place of little more than 100,000 inhabitants, or Dernawis as they are known in Libya. It's renowned for its cultural life and its gardens, and for producing what are considered the best fruits in Libya. Many of Libya's leading artists and writers have roots in the town. But post-Gaddafi Derna has struggled, not just with extremists, at one point Islamic State militants embedded themselves in the town, but also neglect by local and national authorities. Residents had long tried to raise the alarm over the poor state of the dams that collapsed last month. But Libya's political elite appears to care for little, apart from its own petty power struggles. This makes the reality of last month's catastrophe even more painful. Unlike Morocco's earthquake the same weekend, Libya's tragedy is that what happened to Derna was partly to do with human negligence. In the first days after the floods, I noticed several Libyan friends of mine sharing a poem by Mustafa El-Trabelsi, a poet from Derna. Khalid Mutawa, one of Libya's most distinguished poets, translated it for a British newspaper. "The rain," Mustafa wrote, "exposes the drenched streets, the cheating contractor, and the failed state. The rain, a sign of goodness, a promise of help, an alarm bell." Mustafa and his wife died in the floods. His poem has since become woven into Libya's collective grief. It has traveled far beyond the country in Khalid's translation. A friend of mine who grew up with Mustafa in Derna became tearful when we discussed how the poem had touched so many people across the world. Relief efforts in Derna have been complicated because Libya has two competing governments. Many Libyans have told me they worry that other critical infrastructure might be on the verge of collapse after years of civil conflict. They worry too about their longer-term future, given Libya is considered particularly vulnerable to climate change. "There is no plan for that, no vision," one former government official complained to me this week. But others hope that last month's tragedy could yet contain the seeds of change. The initial shock has already transformed into calls for accountability. Many Libyans want an international investigation into what happened in Derna and whether it could have been prevented. They don't trust their own authorities. Derna could be a turning point, one Libyan human rights activist told me this week. That's our hope. For World Report, this is Mary Fitzgerald.
Next we go to Bangladesh, where over 100 global figures have called on the Bangladeshi Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina to stop the persecution of Nobel laureate Muhammad Yunus. Professor Yunus, known internationally as the Banker of the Poor, has been hit with multiple lawsuits and several more have been filed in recent weeks. Sajida Momin has this report.
83-year-old Muhammad Yunus is arguably the most famous Bangladeshi alive today. He is a hero in his country. Since winning the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006, for ushering in rapid economic development. His groundbreaking work in microfinance is globally recognized and implemented in many countries, including Bangladesh, to fight rural poverty. Known as the banker of the poor, particularly women who he has pulled out of extreme poverty, he enjoys a huge following outside Bangladesh too, and can count many world leaders among his personal friends. But this month, Yunus had to cut short a trip to the United Nations headquarters in New York in order to appear before the Anti-Corruption Commission in the capital, Dhaka. As he left the tribunal after being grilled for more than an hour, Yunus defiantly declared that he is not scared as he has not committed any offence. He said that his own integrity is beyond reproach, and yet he is being hounded by those in positions of authority. He didn't name anyone, but everyone knows who the celebrated economist was alluding to. According to his lawyers, he is innocent, but many more court appearances are scheduled in the coming months. The Nobel laureate's misfortune is that he has fallen foul of Bangladeshi Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, who is 77 years old herself and is known to be unforgiving. She has been waging a campaign for years to discredit and defame Yunus, and it has all the hallmarks of a personal vendetta. The Premier has publicly slammed the Nobel laureate as a bloodsucker of the poor, and her various ministers keep attacking him to please her. The case, which necessitated his recent appearance before the Anti-Corruption Commission, is only one among 175 separate criminal and labour tribunal cases related to institutions he set up in Bangladesh aimed at creating jobs and bringing services to the poor. All the cases have been slapped on Yunus either by Hasina's government or litigants backed by the administration. Yunus is being made to pay for the crime of toying with the idea of launching a political party to take on Hasina's Awami League way back in 2007. At that time, both Hasina and her bitter rival, Begum Khalida Zia of the Bangladesh Nationalist Party, were thrown into prison by the army-backed interim administration. As Bangladesh's most famous son, Yunus responded to calls by ordinary Bangladeshis to set up a political party and defeat the Awami League and Bangladesh Nationalist Party to weed out corruption from governance. He formally launched a party called Nagrik Shakti, or Citizens' Power, and dramatically announced, "I just can't keep myself away from politics any longer. It's high time to do something." Although he abandoned his political career in 2 months as he felt like a fish out of water, he is still bearing the cross. Hasina, who won the 2008 elections, hasn't forgiven him for wading into politics and calling politicians corrupt. After winning 3 successive national elections in 2008, 2014 and 2018, she is keen to become the prime minister for a record 4th term. The barrage of cases Yunus is having to fight shows the extent to which Hasina is using the judiciary to hound and harass him. And unfortunately for Yunus, courts in Bangladesh today are increasingly towing and endorsing the government's line and denying the accused the protection that they are legally entitled to. Recently, as many as 170 global leaders wrote a strongly worded letter to Hasina to stop the judicial harassment of Yunus. Among the signatories are former US Presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton, former United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, and over 100 Nobel laureates. But Hasina is sticking to her guns. She denies that Yunus has been framed and has told the signatories to stop lobbying for him as it amounts to meddling in the internal affairs of Bangladesh. The judiciary is a key state institution Hasina has captured during her long stint in power. Judges have become her collaborators in immobilizing the political opposition, civil society, journalists, and any dissenter questioning her. 50% of the 5 million members of the main opposition party, Bangladesh Nationalist Party, are running from court to court, coping with trumped-up charges instead of fighting the ruling party. Many analysts fear that democracy is being choked to death in the country's courtrooms. And as Hasina is tipped to become Prime Minister for a record 4th term, there is no end to Yunus's travails in sight. This is Sajida Momin in India for World Report.
Finally, we go to Kenya. Over the last decade, hundreds of people have been killed by terrorists belonging to Al-Shabaab, an organisation emanating from Somalia, which has been battling the army on the borderlands between Somalia and Kenya. Less than 100 kilometres from the Somali border lies the island of Lamu. Killings have soared in the county to which the island belongs over the last 6 months. On the surface, some on both sides of the religious divide suggest that it's another battle in the holy war between Christianity and Islam. But beneath that divisive narrative lies a more nuanced struggle between the few who wield power and the many who lack it, as Gareth Mason reports from Lamu town in Kenya.
My alarm clock wakes me at around 4:30 and comes without a snooze button. The call to prayer marks the coming of dawn in Lamu town. The mosque behind my bedroom instantly reminded me how far I am from my London home. And there's little in the bustle of its harbour, jammed with ancient dhow fishing boats, to suggest we're in the 21st century, particularly when the random power cuts strike. Donkeys trudge gloomily in the absence of cars. A Swahili greeting of habari or jambo works as well as an Arabic salam alaikum. And if you're shy about language skills, most people speak English too. The Islamic culture that dominates this ancient port reflects 800 years of seafaring trade around the full arc of the Indian Ocean, from South Africa and up to the Swahili coast, across to the Middle East and down to Indonesia. A respectful harmony seems to exist here between the largely Islamic population and foreign visitors such as myself and those from Kenya's Christian interior. But the newspaper headlines and statistics suggest otherwise. After taking a train from Nairobi to Mombasa, I discussed my onward trip with a local journalist. Willis was blunt in his assessment. He was adamant that I abandoned my plans to travel by bus to Lamu County. "Don't do it. Fly," he said. Advice suggested too by the Irish, British and US government websites, which all suggested exercising extreme vigilance. "Stay in your hotel for your own safety," Willis warned. "Wait there till I find you." "What are you talking about, Willis?" I was tempted to say, having just spent 3 hours walking around Mombasa Old Town without incident. Then again, the enthusiastic welcome I received in a local, otherwise deserted, street-side restaurant also came with a certain element of surprise. Pink-skinned tourists from traditionally Christian countries were thin on the ground, away from the glitzy resorts that lie outside of Mombasa Island. When Willis said that Al-Shabaab informers passed on the details of tourists buying bus tickets to terrorists further up the coast, I bowed to his local knowledge and booked a flight. The killings in Lamu County have not crossed the narrow water dividing the mainland from the island. This is perhaps due to terrorists from Al-Shabaab needing the shelter of the mainland coastal forests. And if Lamu town feels safe, the only danger to those staying in the upmarket tourist trap of Shella, 5 kilometres downbeach, comes from overspending in the bars and restaurants or overstretching in yoga class. Tensions with the minority Christian community are not an underlying factor with the Muslim locals, but the sources of power and authority do invite heavy suspicion for their role in the economic poverty that prevails in town and country. The C-word, corruption, has long been associated in Kenya. Transparency International ranks the nation at a lowly 123. The dominant political force in the country has long been the Kikuyu, the largest of around 40 or so major tribes in Kenya. The Kikuyu, a largely Christian group, make up around 8 million of the country's 55 million people. It's widely felt that Kikuyu influence is often vital for getting on in Kenya, and that this inequity is behind many of the disputed land grabs that have long plagued the country. In the coastal region around Lamu County, land prices have risen in value and stoked tensions among local landowners who don't trust in legal processes to support their claims. The ongoing building of Lamu Port, a massive infrastructure project that aims to make the port the major hub for shipping along the East African coast, has supported this inflation. Suspicions abound that rapacious outsiders are muscling in with the help of dodgy contracts. And when the ranks of the dispossessed are swelled, local recruitment grows of angry young men to destructive organisations like Al-Shabaab. Most folk on all sides have no truck with such brutal and medieval ideologies. But while the perceived injustices of the land grabs continue, the internal problem of al-Shabaab is likely to remain. And while it does so, the road to Lamu will still come with a health warning. For RTE, this is Gareth Mason from Lamu Town in Kenya.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.